In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about AutoShark, Drip, and Hittail. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 136. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the good word this week, Mike?
I'm sweating in Texas.
And it's swampy.
Swampy is a good way to put it.
Well, we're going to be talking today on the show. It's going to be an update show where we talk a lot about projects we've been working on recently, progress we've made or lack thereof in some cases. We got a comment on last week's episode, episode 135, where we answered several listener questions. And Ray piped in. He put a comment on the blog and he said, "The question about the 19-year-old who doesn't have any programming experience. I think I'd be tempted to suggest he try and complete some of the free online courses that are all the rage at the moment. They are available, I think, for HTML, CSS, Ruby on Rails, for example, and might be a quick way to build some basic skills quickly. It would be difficult to pick a technology stack if you have no experience. I would do that first, then look at some freelancing jobs. With no skills, I think even finding the right freelance jobs and getting them would be almost impossible." I thought we said that. Did we skip that step? Because that's the first thing we should have said is first learn something and then go to Odesk and try to get contracts.
Part of that comment also kind of includes the idea that he doesn't know the technology stack, so he doesn't necessarily know where to start. And we kind of gave some ideas about where to start, which was, you know, go to the Ruby on Rails route or PHP or something along those lines, just to get your feet wet and in a way that's not going to overwhelm you.
Thanks for the clarification there, Ray. The other thing we got was an email from Matt Vanderpool, and he attended MicroConf last month, and the subject line of his email is, "Heartfelt thank you for putting on MicroConf." And he says, "Hey, Rob and Mike, wanted to extend a heartfelt thank you to both of you for organizing MicroConf. I also wanted to tell you a little about what MicroConf has done for QATab. Matt has an app called QATab that's at QATab.com, and it helps companies improve their QA process. He says, in the 4 months before MicroConf, I did nothing with QATab. I was too busy and didn't have the time to work on it. In the 1 month since MicroConf, I have reduced my consulting time so that I could work on QATab, added support for integrating with external ticketing systems based on information from Tom Fakes, who I met at MicroConf, set up a weekly meeting for product accountability with Najaf Ali, who I met at MicroConf, identified and reviewed competitors to help me determine what makes QATab different." And then he lists five or six other things, all dealing with either information he got from MicroConf or people he met at MicroConf. And he says, "I don't know if I would ever have made this progress without it. The talks were great and the networking was even better. Almost everyone who I explained the QATab concept to immediately got it, and that was very helpful. I think it was this kind of feedback that I was missing and that I really needed to keep going. Again, thank you." So, we want to extend, a thank you to Matt for writing it with such a detailed email. Yeah, really just for letting us know the difference it makes. And that's frankly why we're starting to do two of them. Certainly, if it works out and it continues to make this kind of difference for people, I just it's kind of a no-brainer.
You know, and we'll have to, you know, take into account those people who are trying to get us to do three or four a year, but
yeah,
we'll see what happens.
I saw an Asia request and an Australia, New Zealand request come through, and we're gonna need some staff to help with those. So, Mike, we haven't heard much about, you know, details of AutoShark, what's going on with that. Probably for a couple of months.
So for the people who haven't heard much of what I've been working on, AutoShark is a product designed for auditing web servers, basically your infrastructure servers, to make sure that you're following best practices for security. Because there are literally thousands and thousands of ways to configure a server, but not all of them are necessarily the right way or a good way that isn't, you know, going to end up in your server getting hacked. So AutoShark is designed to check all these different pieces of information on your servers to make sure that the server's configured correctly out of the box, you know, when you first start configuring it, and then to continually make sure that it's still configured the right way in case those baseline recommendations change, or if the server changes itself. So if, for example, you know, somebody actually does get into your server and hacks into it, chances are good that they're going to start making some changes to it. And those are the types of things that you don't necessarily, you want to be notified about. And they're not things that you're going to go back into the server and check on a daily basis. You'd rather have software that'll do that. So that's what AuditShark is designed to do. From a problem standpoint, obviously, it's giving you some, at least peace of mind that somebody's going in and taking a look at these servers, making sure that it's set up correctly. You know, those those are the types of things that, you know, people I've spoken to find fairly valuable about it. So over the past few weeks, I've been making a very focused effort to kind of get the product more or less to feature complete, where it is enough to put in front of somebody where they would actually get value out of it. So to help with that, I hired a developer to start building some of these control points. I spent some time doing some training for him. Over the past couple of weeks, he's put together roughly between 100 and 150 different security checks that are built into the product now, and they're all targeted at Windows 2008. And that's just more or less the starting point. Next up on the docket is going after SQL Server 2008. And then after that, I'm going to start taking a look to figure out whether we want to do more Windows checks and go down the route of Windows 2012 and SQL 2012, or if we want to start going more towards the Linux side of things with Linux-based apps such as Apache or MySQL, or if we go after more of a platform-specific approach where we're going to maybe say Ruby on Rails gems or things like that. But essentially, in order to make those decisions, I have to do a little bit more customer development.
And does that mean, are you able to ask them in advance and figure that out, or do you have to go through the process of actually installing it on their server, getting them to use it, and then making the decision?
No, I can just talk to them. I can ask them the questions. I can look at my spreadsheet to figure out what the numbers are of the people who are interested in different things and just go after the largest pieces, figure out who is, one, willing to pay the most for it, and then two, what the largest number of people who are willing to pay that amount. You know, just do a little bit of multiplication. You can figure out what's going to be the most profitable area to go after next, at least from my launch list and the people that I've talked to so far. Obviously, if I start progressing and marketing a lot more, then that could change dramatically very, very quickly. But it's at least a starting point to give me an idea. But the fact that he was able to put together roughly 50 control points a week indicates to me that over the course of the next month or 2 months, it wouldn't be a stretch to have like another 250, 300, 400 control points built, where these are all each individual checks and security checks that are being done on somebody's machine that would be reported on a daily basis. And I think that regardless of the system that you're running, there's going to be value in that. And that's really what I've spent a lot of time and effort getting to the point of, is where I know that the system actually provides that value, because that is the value proposition. If it doesn't deliver, it's very difficult to justify charging for it.
Right, that makes sense. And have you limited this to, or do you know yet who's going to get the most value out of it? Like, is it SaaS operators? Is it downloadable software companies? Is there any group or demographic that it's particularly resonated with?
Not that I've differentiated. I mean, I can certainly make guesses about it. My suspicion is that any company that bases, 95 to 99% of its revenue off of its web servers, they would be a good candidate for it, because they're going to want to make sure that those servers don't go down, whether it's because of, bad configurations or hackers getting in. We talked a little bit about Rudy a couple of weeks ago, where his backups were failing and he didn't know that that was going on. I could very well build a control point that checks and validates your backups, for example. And if your backups are failing, let's say I check the log files for backups, or there are very specific things I can look at, I could tell you whether your backups are failing. And then it's not 6 months, 9 months down the road when your entire server crashes, and then suddenly you find that your backups were failing, 7 months ago, and you're completely toast. Then something like that would provide a lot of value. But it is for those types of people who have, the vast majority of their revenue coming from those servers, because they basically are mission critical. If you lose those servers, you lose your business. Now, again, that's just hypotheticals, theories. I can sit here and talk till I'm blue in the face and say, yeah, that sounds reasonable. But until I go talk to customers and say, is this why you're buying this product? It's hard to make those judgment calls.
Right. Because the answer you gave me was the problem that you solve, right? You talked about a problem someone has and how AutoShark could solve it. And that totally makes sense. Problem solution fit, I think you're going to find that. What I'm asking about is that next step, product market fit. It's what market are you going to focus on first with your limited resources, being a single founder? You can't go after everyone who has 90% of their revenue from their web server, because that's a huge, huge market, and you just can't possibly market to them. So that's what I was probing after, is who is that demographic?
Yeah, it's probably going to be SaaS operators initially, just because I'm kind of plugged into that network to some degree. So I understand kind of the pulse of the market a little bit. And I understand a lot about how web servers work, what the problems around running them are, what the remediation issues are. And I can certainly offer a lot of value there in terms of not just my knowledge, but in the product's applicability to solving those situations. So it seems to me like that's a reasonable place to start. Whether I stay there or not, it depends a lot on how the market responds to what I'm offering.
I like it. That's a good answer. At least you have one, you know, that's not broad, because that is definitely a market that you have reach into.
You'd mentioned a while ago that you were working on a couple of information products, and I know that one of the first things was the video course on hiring a VA. I think you'd done a bunch of stuff back in January where you'd had somebody come in and do a lot of videos of you, but how's that coming along?
It was ready to launch. I mean, I had all the videos by January, and I was hoping to launch it in January, and then Hittail had a big spike and a bunch of press, and you know, it was great stuff. Hittail grew very, very fast early in the year, and it took my attention off of the video course, basically. That I have kind of a goal to launch 3 courses this year, just smaller things that, you know, really focus on a particular pain point. And so I put the VA video course on hold, but I've been getting emails about it, probably 1 or 2 a month from, you know, whoever, listeners, people who hear about it, and asking if I've launched it yet, or, you know, where I'm going to launch it, because I don't have a landing page for this one. This is probably the first time I've ever done this. I just plan to send it to my email newsletter list that, you know, it's softwarebyrob.com. There, I have a newsletter for that. I'm going to test that out, and thinking that in the next, it's going to probably be 7 to 14 days that I'm going to get it out. It's all uploaded. I have transcripts. I have audio versions. I have course notes. There's really just 1 or 2 final pieces. I have a job description that I used already uploaded that I used to hire VAs. And then there's just a couple, like I want to get a sample screencast and a sample Google Doc that I share, just showing how simple it actually is to train someone to do something. So I'm excited. It's fun. I like sharing this kind of information and being able to justify going into such depth. You can't do it on a podcast. You can't really do it in a talk at a conference. I'm going deeper than I've gone probably since my book. You know, that's the last time I really dove into something with this much detail, and I'm able to hand over so many like accompanying resources.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'd be interested in, you know, seeing that. I know that there's a lot of people who, you know, just I reply to, and there were several people I talked to at MicroConf who were asking me, they're like, you know, wow, you're involved in a lot. You do a lot of different things. How do you get all of this stuff done? And I'm like, well, the magic of it is I don't actually do most of it.
Right.
So as you said, it's through VAs, and you get other people to basically work through your processes.
Yeah, that's right. With Hittail, it's kind of been a trip. One of my main marketing channels just stopped working very abruptly. It's actually an algorithmic thing. It's a paid acquisition that I've been doing for about 8 or 9 months. And I'd stopped it for MicroConf because I was too busy. And when I came back and re-upped it, just like ads aren't appearing even with the same bids. It's been kind of a shocker. It's not the majority of growth, but it has been the longest term and most stable, and it is a big chunk of the monthly growth that's been happening, you know, over the past probably 8 to 9 months. And so the nice part is that it's a SaaS app, and that SaaS is beautiful because the money, you know, keeps coming in, right? Your revenue it may not grow substantially this month. Like it's been growing between 10 and 30% a month for 15 months. And the growth this month will be single digits at best, but it's SaaS. Like the revenue still comes in. It's not like with the single download software products that I've had, where when growth stops, it really, you know, drops down substantially and you lose 50% or 80% of your revenue in a month.
That's nice to hear. As long as you've got that growth coming in, I think the thing that would concern me, and obviously I'm not, you know, seeing all your numbers and everything, but if I were in that position, what would concern me is the fact that if you lose like a major growth engine, does that mean that in another month or two, because that growth engine is lost, now as you start to shed people who came in through that engine, are you going to start going in the other direction? Are you going to start to shrink because that growth is no longer being powered by that particular channel?
Oh, absolutely. If churn is too high and you don't have that large funnel of trials coming in, you will start to shrink. I've plotted it all out because it's been going on for about 6 weeks now. And it's funny, I'm like working with an ad provider and all this stuff, and they don't really know how their system works. It's like this black box algorithm, and there's no flags on my account. There's nothing. Like, they're like, we don't know why it's not running. I mean, it's bizarre. And so I'm doing all types of crazy testing, like pointing it to running the same ad, but pointing it to just a completely different website, like pointing it to my blog to see if the ad shows up. Yo, you're right. If there's, you know, if you lose a major growth engine and your churn is too high, then of course a SaaS app will shrink over time. This is obviously a concern. It's not something I don't want to play it off and say, oh, since it's SaaS, I'm immune to X, Y, and Z, because it's certainly not the case at all. And this is a major issue on my plate right now, which is a bit of a bummer because I had all these processes in place that essentially are ensuring the growth, the continued growth of Hitdale, even though I'm not focusing on it. And when something like this happens, this is where I've had to pull away from what I was working on, which was Drip. And I've had to pull away from it and come back. And so I'm now getting less done on, you know, on the new project. This is a balancing act. When processes fail and you have to step back, I think that's probably it's the part that I don't enjoy about having a lot of spinning plates, is when one that I started spinning a long time ago that's been going well for a long time suddenly starts to wobble and I have to take my attention off of the new ones.
Yeah, that's always hard. That's also one of the reasons you don't automate everything up front, because if that automation fails for whatever reason, it's going to take a long time to automate to begin with. But then if that automation fails, then it's going to take you exponentially more time to figure out how to go back and fix everything, especially depending on what it is. If it's complicated or somebody changes their API or changes their web page and you're parsing it, and you know, it could just be really difficult. But yeah, when those processes break down, sometimes there's just nothing you can do. You have to go back and take a look at it.
Right. So let's bounce back to some of the other things on your list. What else is new?
Well, last week I was trying to get a customer installed and basically ran into a couple of things because I wanted to get some of the control points that I talked about that I was having the new developer work on out into the system and tested. So we were making a lot of changes all at once, and I don't know whether it was directly related to something that we did or whether it's just the sheer number of control points that were added to the system that basically results are not coming back anymore. So that I just basically found this out over the past day or two, because the policies that I put in place to go out and audit my test machines, they're just not sending the results back anymore. They used to. They were doing it fine every single day, and now it's a black hole.
That's not good.
I think that I've got enough login code in place to figure it out. It's just I haven't had the time to sit down on the servers and figure out exactly what's going on. I mean, it may very well be something as simple as a configuration change in a config file someplace on the server, but it could be something that's a lot more complicated than that. And I know that this whole mechanism for passing that data back has got to change at some point. I think that was Gabriel Weinberg had written a article talking about scalability and how it can usually see the next order of magnitude of growth, but two orders of magnitude, things are going to be so completely different that it's very difficult to figure out what's going on or what it's going to look like. And I think that it's kind of at that stage right now where, before I was only passing back a handful of control points where it was less than 10. And at this point, I'm sending back pretty close to 150. So it really is a full order of magnitude higher than it was before. I don't know what the problem is. It could be something simple. It may require some radical changes. I'm hoping it's not radical changes, but again, it's a problem where I've got to deal with it, and I've got to deal with it now because obviously I don't want to start putting a lot more customers into this and then having them log in and have them not be able to do anything at all because, you know, the system just doesn't work anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty major one to find early on. This is exactly why we roll out to one customer at a time and test things. It is a beta test in this case, but it's also, I guess, one of the other big benefits that we've talked about a lot is you're learning what, you know, which features your customers need, and they push the limits of these things, right? Because you just wouldn't likely test with that many control points.
Oh, no, I would. I could easily foresee somebody running 500 or 1,000 or even 1,500 or 2,000 control points against a single machine.
Right.
Because you're not going to want to do those manually, because even if it took you like 5 seconds to check each one of them, I could easily see somebody doing that in a production environment. And this is only 100 to 150. So it's got to get fixed. It absolutely has to get fixed.
Very good. Well, so basically the month since MicroConf has not treated me well at all. I've just now, after a month, just about out from under the email load that had piled up, then the Hitdale growth has stalled, and now Drip.
Is this Tales from the Dark Side?
It is, man. It's just one of those bad months. I was down like last week and the week before, I was really bummed about these things and they were impacting me. Yeah, I was really shocked by it and surprised and everything. And I'm just kind of like dealing with it now and realizing that I'll figure out a solution eventually. And the same thing with drip. So with drip, probably 3.5-4 weeks ago, we started working with our customer number one, because Hittail's been using drip for a while and it works, and drip sending email and everything works great. We tried to get customer number one on the system, and right away it was like, oh, you don't have this feature that I absolutely need. So we implemented it. And then there were a couple more that he needed, and we implemented them. As we went down the line, it just turned out his use case was way too complicated. He had so many landing pages and lists, and they interacted, and he had custom segments, and he had API calls. And not that that stuff is that bad, but at this point in Drip's life cycle, it's just not there, right? We can't build all that. We could have spent another month building it for him, and maybe it's 1 out of 50 or 1 out of 100 potential customers has all the problems he did. So the cool part is that he was able to switch, since he's a founder as well, he was able to switch pretty quickly from customer to kind of advisor, you know. And we had a long hangout with myself and Derek, who's coding it, and customer number one. And he was basically like, you know, you really got to think. I don't know if I would build all these features yet. And so that's what we decided to do. We basically pulled the plug on just on getting customer number one on the app. And so we've had to switch up the plan a little bit and take evasive action. And you know, I have 16 other early access customers. And so I'm now choosing one who has a pretty simple use case, and we've started talking. And I would love to get him on board like today. But as this is going on, Derek and I start talking, and he realizes just during the conversations that we have to do some refactoring of the data model. That it was, yep, that you know how painful that's going to be.
Yep.
So it felt like a 1-2 punch, man. Basically, Derek, he's like, do you have time to chat? You know, and I'm like, this is not good. We never chat unless something's wrong, you know? We started talking, and it was basically a 90-minute Skype chat of me trying to figure out how we could avoid doing this. You know, it's about 8 working days. Once we get data in the system and we have users on it, it would be one of those changes where it would literally take 3 to 6 man months to fix down the line if we had to migrate everybody. And so it was that kind of thing where it's like, oh, this gets us 80% of the way there, but it's going to be catastrophic if we ever have to add one additional, you know, variation of this or one additional piece of flexibility. We just saw quickly how that architecture had maxed itself out. So we're several days into that. I think probably 3-4 days from now, that will be done. And then we'll be circling back and getting our next customer number one on. But the good news I realize is that every feature we built for our first customer number one, we are going to need. We're going to need for ourselves or for this next customer number one. So we didn't lose time per se. You know, we didn't waste time.
Yeah, I think the one thing that you mentioned that's really important for some people to think about is that, you know, you may have your heart set on signing on this, you know, customer number one, but understand and realize that it may not work out with that customer. They may have use cases or needs that are going to be so far above and beyond what the rest of your customers are going to want or need that it's actually not worth building it for them, because you're going to end up doing all these customizations that are never going to be used by anybody else, or going to be very difficult, or going to be so time consuming that it's going to set you so far back from launching that at the end of the day, it's not going to be profitable, or you're going to lose motivation, or you're just not going to have the money to be able to make ends meet to roll it out to everybody. So being able to walk away from that customer one and say, look, we just can't help you right now. We may be able to do it at some point in the future, but now is just not the right time. And in some cases, that's the right decision to make. It's not an easy decision to make, but sometimes it's the right one.
That's what I was going to say. It was not an easy decision at all. It was not clear cut. At a certain point, it just starts feeling intuitively wrong, like you are doing so much work. And I kept asking myself the question, how many other users of my first 100 are going to need what we're building here? And that answer was like none or one. It was just such a small percentage that I know we can get quite a few people using and paying for the app without these features. And that was, and again, it's a judgment call. Someone else may have made a different one. But the thing that struck me was that no matter how many emails and how many times I discussed it with customer number one and tried to thoroughly understand his use case, there were still these little things that crept up once he tried to implement. So it just goes back to that recommendation of get people actually using your app, because expect things to come up that you haven't accounted for. I don't know if I honestly believe you can account for things until they really start touching the code.
Because there's always this difference between, like, you know, you can explain an idea to somebody else, and until you've explained it to them three or four times and actually showed them what you're talking about, it is so hard to convey some of that stuff. I mean, and that's part of why, you know, when we're talking about outsourcing code to developers, and that's why it makes those the screen mock-ups so incredibly important, because it allows you to show them quickly what you're talking about versus having them read a spec that they're only going to skim anyway, and they're not going to really understand it, even if you're talking to it right in their ear. So, hey, I've got some of my, you know, own tales from the dark side. I'm letting go of one of my developers. I've had to get on to him a number of times over the past several months, and it's really just not working out. I mean, the relationship has just kind of limped along for about 6 months, and I feel like I've tolerated it because I felt like I didn't necessarily have a choice, and I didn't want to put the time and effort into finding somebody else. But I've decided to just kill the relationship and focus on more on people who are actually working out.
That's a bummer. I'm sorry to hear that. Is he one of your, you have a couple domestic developers, is that right? Here
yeah.
In the US.
Yeah. Yep. He's not one of them.
Oh, he's not. Okay.
No.
All right.
No.
Well, that's a bummer. I mean, you have other help. Are they able to step up and make up for him, or are you going to have to go on a search for someone?
The lead developer who I have working on the policy builder, and then the other developer I have who's using the policy builder, that's really where a lot of the problems are. And we've had these discussions internally where we're looking at it, and all of the problems with the policy builder, you know, with the synchronization, and none of it's really major, but collectively it tends to be a pain. So we're actually looking at that stuff and trying to figure out, what is the future of this going to look like? What are we going to do in the future? How is it going to work? We've talked about some different architecture consideration, and it almost seems like the original thought that I'd had a long time ago was to take the policy builder and put it in the web so you didn't have to have this additional downloadable component. And it looks like that's probably the direction that we're going to go. For now, we're going to leave things the way that they are, just because it would be an incredible waste of time and effort to just say, to back off and put things on hold and go back and rebuild it in the web. So we're just going to leave things the way they are. We're going to basically work through the issues as best as we can. The developer who's building a lot of the control points has had a lot of good feedback for me in terms of what the policy builder needs. But a lot of those suggestions are directly applicable to taking it and making it web-based as well, just using like jQuery or something along those lines. I think that that's ultimately the direction we'll go. And if that's the case, then this developer was working on that policy builder. So if I basically halt the development there and put it in maintenance mode, it doesn't necessarily matter that I've kind of lost him.
Oh, that's funny. I hadn't realized that the policy builder wasn't web-based. Yeah, I can see the headaches of trying to build it on the web instead of as a desktop app. But I agree with you. I think that's a no-brainer long-term, because then you don't have to support people downloading and installing and running into all those issues that are hard to troubleshoot, as opposed to you having kind of a SaaS thing that you can maintain and fix right on the fly.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing with the policy builder is that, you know, there's going to be people out there who have Macs. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who have Macs, and it's Windows only right now. So moving it into the web, it solves a lot of those problems. The other thing that it does is it allows us to avoid any database synchronization problems. You don't have to have a SQL server on the client to run it. There's some things along licensing that I can probably get away with a couple of components that I won't need anymore. The major issue that it kind of brings in is how to test things. So once you've built a policy or a control point, how do you test it? And for something like that, I think that we're going to move more towards an always connected model, where if you push a task down to a machine because it's going to maintain a constant connection out to Audit Shark and the cloud, then it'll always be able to contact it. You know, you'll be able to do it directly through the UI, which will be pretty neat if we can get it working. And I don't see any reason why we can't. It's just a matter of wiring all that stuff up. And that's a non-trivial amount of work. So that's kind of the reason for putting things kind of in a maintenance mode for that, while in parallel we walk down the road of building this other stuff.
Absolutely. At this point, man, I mean, we're both kind of in the same boat, right? We're approaching launch on something. And I find myself every day saying, that's a great feature. I'm entering it in Fogbugs and putting it at priority 6 or 7. Like, a great feature, we're going to build it in 6 months. That's typically the time frame. You know, I'll say we'll build it for 2.0. There's some awesome features. I can think of 100 features I would want in an email marketing tool, but we can put them in a bug tracker and implement them later, right? Because right now we just got to implement the shortest path to providing actual monetizable value to people. And that's the same boat you're in. Writing less code and doing more things to get you closer to launch, frankly.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that is if you can get to launch and you know it starts to gain traction, then obviously you're going to be gaining revenue from it, and you can bring more people on to build that version 2.0 kind of in parallel while you've got version 1.0 in maintenance mode.
So my last update for the day is also dealing with drip. I had this really interesting experience last week. About 2 weeks ago, we bailed on trying to get customer one on, and then we decided to refactor. So we were in kind of just standstill mode, and I was looking at the feature set and really asking myself, what exactly are we building? And is this still in line with my original vision of drip that I had way back? Is that still something people are willing to pay for? Does it provide value to a market? The answer was, I think so, but I don't really know. And so I was trying to think, how do I answer this better? How do I find out what people really want? Because I've had so many one-off conversations, whether it's at MicroConf or whether it's over Skype or whether it's one-on-one via email. And when people say, I'm really looking forward to drip, I ask them, what exactly do you think it does? Because I haven't spelled out what the features are, and everybody has a different answer. Some people want behavioral email. Some people want workflow-based email. Some people, you know, there's all these things that people want. And I was trying to figure out how many of them want each of these things. So realizing that the launch list, I have an email list of about 1,400 people who have expressed interest in drip. And they've come from all different sources, from probably listeners of this podcast to people who heard about it at MicroConf to ads that I've run, sending them to a landing page. And so I created a Google form. I love Google Form. It's like WooFoo, but it's super simple. You create this form. They have quite a few options. Nothing like WooFoo because it's free, and everything goes into a Google Docs spreadsheet when the info comes in. So I created one of those. I sent out a link, tried to keep it as short as possible, and I got a lot of responses. Got a 22% response rate, answered some really key questions, and some of them were directly in line with kind of my hypothesis, and others sent me in a different direction, frankly. But the most important thing is it really improved my mental state of like, are we wandering here? Are we really building something people want? And it totally confirmed that, because an overwhelming number of people who responded and the percentage of people who responded want exactly what we've already built, to be honest. If we weren't refactoring right now, we, based on what drip is today and based on how I described it in this survey, we have a kind of a critical mass in that group. So, but the key thing that we asked that I almost didn't ask, I added it in last, was question number one was basically saying, are you a, and then there were choices, and it was like, are you a startup founder / software entrepreneur? Or are you an email marketer or a general marketer or an other? And then there was a text box. And so other wound up being like consultants and just kind of some random people. That was key, because then all of the other responses I could segment in that Google spreadsheet, and I could just, you know, order by one thing. And then I could look at how many startup founders said that particular thing and how many email marketers said that particular thing. And that was a really key insight that I'm glad I'd done. So folks out there, if you are going to send out a survey, you don't want to ask 5 questions about who they are. You want to try to boil it down to 1 so that it doesn't, you know, really clog up the survey.
Yeah, that's a good thing to ask. One of the things I've been doing is taking a look at the email addresses of the people who've been signing up for the AudioShark launch list. And using Reportive, you can basically backtrack their email address to see who they are, where they work at, and what their title is at that company. And that's extremely helpful for figuring out whether it's more of a qualified lead than, you know, somebody who's just kind of idly interested. I mean, if they sign up for AudioShark and they've got like a Gmail account, chances are pretty good so far that I've found that they're not necessarily interested. It's more because it's a podcast lister, or they've heard about it from my blog or something like that, and they're kind of idly curious. Whereas I've gotten a lot of other emails that have come in, and I've been able to backtrack it to companies for legitimate corporate email addresses. And, you know, some of the titles are like, you know, operations engineer or sysadmin at such and such company. And it's clear that they're looking to solve a very specific problem. And, you know, you can reply to those people, or you can go back to them either one-on-one or with a survey like that with some very detailed and specific questions. And by cross-segmenting those types of people, you can send them different questions so that you can essentially say, okay, well, sysadmins are interested in these types of things. Let me drill in for the next sysadmin who comes along. Let me send them a survey that kind of drills in to try and get more information about what a sysadmin would look for, as opposed to, you know, somebody who's just kind of curious or kind of a drive-by person.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that because I had forgotten to mention that one of the choices on the for after identifying who they were, I asked them, you know, what's the number one thing you think Drip's going to do? Like, what are you most excited about? I gave them a few choices. And one of those choices was, I'm just curious about Drip. And that having that alone, I think like 20% of the respondents said that. And that was great because I was able to basically not listen to their opinion as much because it's not as important as a founder's opinion who can actually use this today and really has a desire to use it.
Yeah, and that's definitely a differentiating factor between them. I mean, if you know what they do or what they are interested in, it helps you determine whether or not to ignore the things that they have to say. And it sounds a little callous, but at the same time, you have to, as a startup founder, you have to choose what advice you listen to. And you have to have some way of doing that, and that's a good way of doing it.
Right. I wouldn't say ignore, I'd say prioritize, right? It just has to be prioritized lower than some of the other groups that I looked at. So there were a couple other things I learned from the survey. I won't go into too much detail, but one I already said so far, which is that all the features that we have built so far, including the ones for customer number one, are important to people. And that was a nice confirmation. Another one is that there were a lot of startup and software founders, which I would have expected. You know, it confirmed it basically with data. And then another one was it was kind of the opposite sides of the coin. There was an advanced feature, which is like split testing, right? Split testing autoresponder sequences against each other, as well as subject lines. I mean, really going in depth. It's a very hard thing to build, but it was on our docket and we had pulled it off because our intuition was that people didn't want anything that complicated. But it was the exact opposite. People were like, this is a major feature that I want now. Like it was a big deal. So we're turning around on that. And then another one was email workflow and trying to almost like Infusionsoft stuff where you are not quite behavioral, but where you have really complex rules engines. I'd heard from so many people that they wanted that. And so I was entertaining the idea of wondering if we had to go down that path because that's not a fun thing to build. Frankly, we found that a smaller percentage wanted that than almost anything else. So although it's a vocal group or it's a group of people who I've talked to a lot because I've heard that suggestion a lot, it's not something that we are going to build tomorrow. And so again, it's not we're not going to ignore that feature, but it's prioritized lower than some of these other things that we're talking about.
The feature for A/B testing or split testing any of the email campaigns, not just the content of them, but like the headlines and stuff to drive people in them. Yeah, that's definitely a feature that you should be working on first. I totally agree with the people who responded in that survey.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long thought process. I won't go into it, but that was originally one of the value props I had mentioned when I was pitching Drip to anybody, was that it could do that because I don't know of any other system that allows you to split test sequences, right? It is autoresponder sequences. It's always, you can split test individual campaigns, individual blast emails, but not sequences. So, but it had fought through a series of discussions and such. We'd moved it off because it's a lot of work to build. But as you said, a lot of folks are interested in it. So we will be building it.
Cool.
Yeah. This really reminds me why having a launch list is so crucial. I've been doing one-on-one interviews with people, like I said, via email and Skype, but it's really hard to get like a higher level idea from that. You get specific requests and it's hard to know how many others have that same problem. And that what the survey data did combined with those interviews is it gives me a much higher confidence in the direction we're taking. It makes me feel better about what we're building and it makes me, I don't know, just have a better outlook on it. It makes me want to move fast and get things done. So, you know, it's not like we don't already tell people to have a landing page and a launch list, but one more reason to have something like that in place.
Maybe you should have one for the VA videos.
Oh my God. We'll see how that goes. It's going to be such an I told you so. Everyone's going to point.
I can see it as the Twitter hashtag tag right now.
Hashtag I told you so?
No, we'll see how that goes. I was reworking some of the marketing stuff on the website right now as well. And, you know, I've reworked the sign-up process a little bit to emphasize some of the things that I took away from MicroConf, like the 60-day money-back guarantee versus a free trial, giving people a little bit more information on the sign-up, doing annual plans versus just a monthly plan, offering that to them up front as opposed to basically offering it after they've already signed up. So I'm looking at doing those types of things. And the only other thing I have going on is about an hour after this podcast ends, I'll be doing our first mastermind group call this evening.
Very nice. Dude, that's a good move. Yeah, mm-hmm. Are you excited about it?
Yeah, I am. I mean, it'll, you know, it's just kind of exploratory at the moment. I mean, we'll do a couple and see how things go. Maybe do one every other week for the next 6 or 8 weeks or something like that. And then I think everybody will kind of evaluate where things are at and whether it's meeting everyone's needs or not, or if we need to change anything. But I'm kind of excited by it and interested in seeing how things go. But we arranged it at MicroConf. So another notch in the plus column for MicroConf.
Yeah, very cool. Looking forward to hearing how that goes, and I'm sure listeners will be interested in updates in the future.
Well, if you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.